Very good. So, brethren, we are continuing in the Revelation study of the trumpets. We would like to pick up with our fourth trumpeter. That's in Revelation 8, verse 12. It's a one-verse trumpet. And Brother Mark Candle, could you read that for us, please? Revelation 8, verse 12.
Revelation 8:12. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, so as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise.
All right, thank you. Brother Mark, could you open with who you might think this fourth messenger trumpeting would be?
The thought is that it would be Waldo.
Okay, very good. Do you have anything on the background of Peter Waldo? Off the top of your head, I know you weren't prepared to give a sermonette.
Well, I know that they were under persecution, and his followers hid in the mountains. I guess they would be called Waldenses.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's about it.
Very good. Very good. We appreciate that. Who else would like to have opening comments on Brother Peter Waldo and the Waldensians? Brother David.
Brother Rick and friends, Peter Waldo was a valiant man, smart. He had a lot of things going on in the time that he was sounding. They had the Crusades. They had the persecution from the popes. Waldo translated Bible into the native French language, and as a result understood that the papacy and many of their trappings were completely false, and he founded, he was pretty much outraged by the way they conducted, that is, the papacy and the priests and such conducted themselves, the hierarchy, that is, and he founded, as Brother Mark said, the Waldensians were basically devoted themselves to the poor and the spread of the word. And Waldo also gave all of his money, or a lot of his money, to the poor. There was also the Black Plague and the persecution of many groups under his sounding. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
All right, very good. I really appreciate that. Sister Alice and Brother Calvin.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. He was called the, what was he called? Can't remember. Anyway, his followers wrote the scriptures that he translated and put them in the pockets in the hems of their garments and went all over Europe. And when they had the opportunity, they would give witness and give these out to people. So it was a real spreading of the Bible for the first time in the language of the people, because he did it in French. And his followers were called the Poor Men of Lyons. He was a rich merchant of Lyons, but gave, like Brother David said, gave all his goods to the poor. And then the Waldensians were persecuted by the Catholic Church. And so they went into the Piedmont Alps, which is a line of Alps between France and Italy. And the Piedmont, that's five. There was like five mountains, groups of mountains. And they would live up there. And when they would come down to the cities, they would cover their horse hooves so that nobody would hear the horses coming down. And then they would do their work, and then they would go up in the Alps. And I read several books on this. So one of the general conventions that was sort of in that area, I took my mom with me, and I wanted to see I had seen photographs of the Bald Indian homes in the Alps, so I wanted to see what they looked like in real. So we went to the Piedmont Alps, and we found that they had a museum of the Waldensians and a cemetery. And then she could not climb the mountains, so I climbed the mountains myself, and she stayed down in the cemetery and the museum. And it was quite a hike, but I did see where the building was, and these are buildings at the size of your bathroom. I mean, they were small. And but this one is where they, Poor Men of Lyons, they would sit and they would have classes and they would write their scriptures out. And then I went up further and I found homes. These were like little blocks of a stone, little tiny houses. You can't imagine anybody living in such a tiny house, but like maybe 5 feet by 5 feet. But these were still preserved and they're still there today. And I have pictures of them, but I couldn't find them, so I can't show them to you. But what they would do up in these Alps is if the Catholics would come, the clergy would come to kill them, they would roll stones down the Alps and it would hit the horses and it would scare them and they would never get them. So these were the Piedmont Alps, and this was the beginning of the translating of the Bible into the languages of the people. Now, he did the four Gospels, but he may have done the whole Bible. I don't remember. That's all.
Okay, very good. And just on your last comment, Sister Alice, I think it was mostly the Gospels and not quite the whole Bible in French, but it was a huge start. And that's a wonderful trip, and we're so glad that you had those experiences, especially with your dear mother, and they make lifelong impressions. Thank you. Brother Godwin.
I think the friends already brought up most of the items about Peter Waldo, but the key things that I've written down for what he was against the Catholic Church were their concepts and doctrines on purgatory, transubstantiation, and apostolic succession. Just like our seventh angel who was the merchant, we see here Peter Waldo also was wealthy, but he used all of his wealth towards the works, and that's why we consider him as the fourth messenger. And like Sister Alice brought out, most of his followers did have a simple life, and that's what they preached around. Thank you.
Very good. I appreciate that. That's more good thoughts brought out, things that he was opposed to with the papists. And, yes, we like that correlationship between our brother Peter Waldo and our brother Russell, both wealthy but fully consecrated. And it reminds us of the verse, not many wealthy, but we need a few, and the Lord has used them mightily. And of course, we spent a lot of time discussing Peter Waldo and his life when we went through the seven churches. And these are the thoughts today to help bring these to mind and round it out for us. Faithful, persecuted Christians at that time. Any other comments on Brother Peter Waldo? Sister Molly or Brother James?
It's me. Good morning. I just wanted to add that I did read that two of the main doctrines that Peter Waldo came to reject or came to understand were the only, well, he called them sacraments, I guess, that Jesus laid forth when he was here were baptism and the institution of the memorial emblems and remembering his sacrifice. So I thought that was unique, that that was in one of the books that I read that they brought that out, those are the two things that he found that Jesus instituted over.
All right, very good, and we certainly appreciate that because that's what we all have thought too. Very good. Thank you. Further comments on Peter Waldo? All right. So we notice here in our verse 12 that we have these thirds, but we have the third part of the sun, the moon, and the stars, just beginning with that. So what I would like us to do is I'd like us to read first in 2 Corinthians 11. And Brother Jeff, did you read there for us? 2 Corinthians 11, verses 13 to 15.
For such people are false apostles, deceitful workers, masquerading as apostles of Christ. It is not surprising, then, that if his servants also masquerade as servants of righteousness, their end will be what their actions deserve.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Any comments on this, Brother Jeff?
Well, I think I'll put this in the 21st century, but I don't say really I enjoy it, but the last part of verse 15 where it says their end will be what their actions deserve. Well, we could put it in now, and there's sadly many millions, if not billions, who I won't say they don't care, that'd be inaccurate, but they don't. There are billions now that don't give a toot of what's going on. And oh God, they give it. Well, if you don't believe that God, if you believe in God and he's in charge, and you follow him through what Christ has given us to follow, then your action will be what you do deserve. And, you know, it's not for us to sit at an intersection around a court and say, well, it's not for us to ever say, including the one in the mirror, well, you know, you're going to fail. Your party's over. That's not how we're supposed to anchor. Not how we're supposed to live. We're supposed to, you know, work with what's in the book here, not what goes on in our set of elements. You know, what goes on there is nice, but I'm sure we believe or feel that we're way ahead of most people, and not that we're better than most people, but we're ahead of them spiritually, I believe. And like I said a few minutes ago, not for us to go somewhere at some very busy intersection or top of some building. They all we're fantastic. No, you know, no one's great. They're just trying to make the best of what we've been given.
All right, thank you, Brother Jeff. Very good. So then, brethren, when we read these verses, what's part of the astounding lesson that Paul's imparting to us? What is part of the rather astounding lesson or insight that the Apostle Paul gives us? All the way back from at the first beginning of the church. Brother Mark.
That, well, from what I picked of it, from that, these false apostles and false teachings disguise themselves as angels of light.
Okay, very good. Right on. Sister Molly?
No, Brother James.
All right.
I know there's no way to tell. The same thought that basically as an enemy or as Satan being the opposition doesn't come across as an enemy, but as a friend, being an angel of light. Over.
All right. Very good. So, brethren, we've seen how Jesus himself referred to Satan as the prince of darkness, and that the world lieth in the wicked one. In other words, he's blinded or has blinded or darkened the minds of the people with his errors and falsehoods. But here in this verse, as Paul is saying, don't be surprised that Satan and his ministers, those men that he worked through, appear as if they are light, or, in other words, they present as if they're putting forth truth, light, when reality is, it is a counterfeit light. It is truth that's not real truth. It's counterfeit, so it's not really true. They present it as truth. But we're warned to look for an antichrist, one who would present themselves instead of Christ or in Christ's place. And we've learned that that is the man of sin, which represents the lineage of the popes who have led the papal church, the premier leading antichrist system. And at the time of the fourth stage of the church, the papacy was near its height of its power, so-called Holy Roman Empire. And in our fourth trumpet, the corresponding time period, we're not surprised when we read that three sources of light, sun, moon, and stars, we're not surprised that one-third or a third part is darkened. So the question becomes, is the one-third part that's darkened, is that really representing those who have accepted the truth of Brother Peter Waldo and the gospel, and that the papists consider that they've gone out of the papal light, the papal counterfeit of the gospel message, the counterfeit of the apostles' teachings, and the counterfeit of the lessons from the types and shadows of the law from the Old Testament? What do you think? Brother Chris says yes. Am I elaborate on that, Brother Chris? And thank you for Waldo behind you.
Well, I mean, I think you just summed it up. We're getting these trumpets are, in my mind, I keep it real simple. It's bad news for the nominal systems. That is from their perspective. So they're seeing stars fall. They're falling from grace from their perspective. They're being excommunicated. They're preaching doctrines that are bringing death to those that used to be their adherents and fill their pews. So the types and shadows of the law that teach the lessons that we refer to that shore up our understanding of what Jesus taught, they discredit it. And I was just thinking, you took us to 2 Corinthians, and Paul is really defending himself. He's saying, you know, just bear with me as I preach myself in folly. It's going to sound silly, but he gives his credentials because there's so many of these that are getting the attention of those in Corinth that he considers them like his children. He's trying to get them nurtured and well-grounded in the truth, and they're listening to these these people coming in, they're very excellent orators, but they're not sticking to the truth. And so Paul brings it out that even Satan, you know, transformed himself into a messenger of light, an angel of light. So don't be deceived by the appearance. Listen to the message and don't focus on the orator who's bringing it. It's the message that's the truth. And so it's the same thing throughout these messengers. They each had to overcome the normal systems that would deal so heavy-handedly with anyone that was a threat. And it's by Waldo's time, like the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day, where they just killed everybody, declared as a heretic. You know, the picture is famous because they're killing all these heretics, but really it's a picture of a massacre of those that held up the standard of God. So, hope that wasn't over long. Over.
Okay, no, thank you, Brother Chris. That's good. Brother Godwin.
Thank you, Brother Rick. So these verses about false apostles reminds me of a verse that Jesus said in Matthew 7:15. Beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep clothing, but inward they are ravening wolves. And also there's a relation to another verse, 2 Peter 2:1, where Peter once again about false prophets.
Okay, very good. It's a good example. Wolf in sheep's clothing. Very good. Ruth?
Well, considering that it's all from the reverse, I like the thought that the sun represents papacy. The papal sun was smitten. Third part of the moon being papacy's canon law. And the third part of the stars was papacy's cardinals, archbishops, and bishops. And that they considered that the Waldenses or the Albigenses cast a shadow on all of them, on all of France, contaminating it. So it's a little bit, it's the same thought, but it's a little reversed over.
What do you mean it's a little reversed? Just to clarify.
Well, the sun, it wouldn't be the true gospel. It would be papacy.
Right.
The moon wouldn't be the true law. It would be papacy's law, canon law. So it's just from that viewpoint. Over.
Yes. And I think it's the same viewpoint. It's just looking at it just expressing it in a different manner. One is taking the true sun, the true moon, the true stars, and just saying that the papacy counterfeited the Bible with its errors. And what you're expressing is true as well, that they have their own clergy arrangement in which they replaced the authority of Jesus and the Old Testament and the authority of the apostles with their counterfeits. And that the dark mean would be those who accepted the truth. I think you were saying this. I correct me if I'm wrong, Ruth. The ones who are the one third who are in the dark, the one third of the sun that's darkened, the one third of the moon that's smitten, and the one third of the stars, that shows those who are accepting the truth. But is that what you're saying? Oh, you know, okay, very good. I can easily not understand correctly what the brethren are all saying. My mind's kind of working on the study and keeping track of what everyone's saying. But that's okay. I'd like to clarify. J and M, J or M?
Yes, it's Brother James. Thank you. I was kind of in it. My comment is in agreement with Sister Ruth. Trying to, that these verses are seeing it from the nominal perspective. And, cause it is kind of hard to go back and forth. So what I have just an anecdote that kind of helps me, remember these verses. And that's, there's a family friend, that is a very devout Catholic. She's quite wealthy and she contributes a lot of money to the Catholic Church all the time. And like, she'll has enough money to pay for whole masses in her honor or whatever, how they do that kind of thing. And she insists that they be in Latin because to her, the Catholic Church has gone astray by not having mass in Latin because it's a holy language. That's what she calls it, a sacred holy language. And so just kind of seeing that, like her frustration with the papacy for not doing, for not forwarding this error. She thinks that they're in the dark because of this. So it's like their view, their erroneous view, like what is in opposition to the truth. And when a little bit of light comes in, then they think that's actually darkness. But really, it's just, the light casts a shadow. So that's what I was thinking with these lights, that it's, the light of truth is casting a shadow on the people that live in error. Over.
All right, very good. And that is very true. What you're bringing out is many ultra-conservative Catholics are not happy with this current pope. They weren't really happy with the results of the First and Second Vatican Councils in the 1960s. And they consider Latin a holy language because that was what the Roman Catholicism adopted and used for centuries. And we're going to talk more about that in our fifth trumpeter. But very good. Thank you. Ruth.
So along James' comment, I was thinking, I don't know if the brethren remember, but at the fair, I don't think it was this year, it was past years, there was a Catholic booth there at the fair. They were promoting Catholicism and the Pope, great big stand-up of the Pope. And one of the ladies that worked there came by our booth, and I was trying to explain our position to her in the ransom. And she would, like, beat her breast. She was so upset, you know, to think about what I was saying. And she would, like, close her eyes and, like, she was, like, in misery, you know, with everything I was saying. And all I was doing was quoting scriptures. So anyway, it reminded me of that. Over.
Yeah, that's it is pretty astounding to see such superstitious error having such hold over the people. All right, good. Thank you. Brother Chris.
Yeah, I wish it was all in Latin. It would serve the people a lot better if they couldn't understand what they were saying. So it's too bad they did change that. But I was just thinking those verses in 1 Corinthians and what we're reading here is that it's talking about these are deceitful false apostles and transformed. So it's a very intentional self-serving. This isn't those that are deceived and then really thinking that they're doing the Lord's work with, honestly fooled and preaching error like a tear. You know, they're honestly deceived. They don't have an agenda. But these church leaders, the papacy, Satan, it's all for self. It's very selfish ambition driven. Just to, bring that out. Over.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Further comments. Brother David Vickery.
Brother Rick, the thought I had was like in Arius, when the pagan church came in, the progression of that and the authority that was given to that established church-state union had a lot of power over the people. And especially because the false church conducted themselves with great authority and pomp and lots of ritual, which the pagan church fostered in amongst the truth sayers so that it corrupted even that. And even though that like this church in Waldo's time, the false church, they still conducted themselves as if they were carriers of light. And anybody with a reasoning mind could see that they were wiping out, they were ruthless people that had not the interest of other people or the love, like Jesus commanded, you know, that you love the Father supremely and love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, they were saying, well, we can love each other better if we wipe out this whole entire race, which just makes no sense as far as Christianity goes. Over.
All right, very unchristian conduct by the papists indeed. So, brethren, we're seeing, I think we're all agreed, that those who were considered in the dark on the Bible truths were those who accepted Peter Waldo's truths and exposed the errors of the counterfeit papal teachings from the Bible. So when we look at this closing aspect of this verse 12, it tells us that the day shone not for a third part, and the night likewise. Well, what shines during the day and what shines during the night? Brother Mark.
The sun and the moon, probably relating to the Old Testament and the New Testament being corrupted.
Okay, very good. Anyone else on that? So it says, if to say that the followers of Waldo and those who accepted the Bible truths who had rejected the counterfeit papal understanding of the Word of God were considered to be in darkness all the time, all day and all night. They were 24 hours in darkness. And that seems to be almost like an expression of emphasis, that though Peter Waldo and the Waldensians were just in darkness, had lost the papal light of the gospel that Satan had provided. And it's usually always a pretty safe guess that when we see it's one third, that's usually the true. And the majority are usually in error during this time period. So we think we have a safe corroboration of our interpretation. Anything more on the fourth trumpet? Ruth?
Well, would we say the third part was like primarily France or the area of the Waldo's influence? Would that be an accurate statement, or are you thinking something else? Over.
Well, I'm thinking it's Peter Waldo and those who accept the teachings of truth from the Bible as they were being presented, which would primarily be that, but weren't the Huguenots during that same time period?
I thought they came about as a result of Waldo, yeah.
So would they be included too, even though they were more England-based?
Well, I don't remember. I thought they were France too, but I could.
Well, maybe they're France too. I'm sorry. But nonetheless, they were considered heretics, and heretics are in the dark as far as the papal light is concerned. So any heretics, any name they had, we're not going to limit it to just Waldo and France, and other heretics aren't included. It's any who rejected papacy's counterfeit interpretation of the Bible were considered by the papacy anywhere to be in darkness. Brother Chris.
Yeah, the other Trump, Arius, we just discussed that all last week. They considered him in darkness. He fell from heaven, and so he was like the great heretic after the apostles that they look at. historically, and now we're looking at the Waldenses, who are bringing out other truth baptism, and those that are they're preaching their errors according to the nominal view. So yeah, it's just they just keep adding heretics. Over.
Yep. Thank you. That's good. So, Ruth, back to you. You're trying to struggle because you want to have three exact parts that we can delineate as three distinct, whereas my emphasis has been on one part in darkness, which are all heretics, and the two-thirds are those who still have the light of the counterfeit light. They still remain papists, which was the majority. Are you trying, is that what you're struggling with, Ruth?
Well, I just thought that when we have three parts, there's three parts, and that, like, in the first one, the three parts was the Jews, the pagans, and the Christians, and then we go to Arius, there were three parts, and now I just thought there was going to be another three parts, but I don't have three parts in mind. I just was curious if that continued or if we're just going to consider the true to be the third, and then that's the important thing. Over.
That's my angle. I don't think beyond that. If someone's got something more on that, we're happy to entertain it. Brother Godwin.
I was just going back to Sister Ruth's comments on Huguenots. We see the time period for Arius from 1157 to 1367, and the Huguenots started in 1491, so that's going to be a succession. But on the comment on the one-thirds last week, we discussed that for any given topic, there may be pros and ones who are against it and some who are undecided. Would that be an application over here, too?
All right. Thank you on the Huguenots. I did have an earlier start date, but that's okay. We appreciate that. Sometimes it's very hard to perfectly date when heretics started because they didn't get their history recorded properly. Their enemies kept their history. But thank you on that. Brother Chris and then Sister Roseanne.
For what it's worth, we might say that one-third that's in darkness is the true, one-third is the nominal religious, and then one-third would be the civil, which was supporting the religious, perhaps. Because in our other thirds, the civil, the pagan civil was part of it, et cetera, et cetera. Over.
All right. Thank you. Good possibility. Sister Roseanne.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up that it was the Albigensians that were another heretical party.
Heretical.
In the 12th century in the south of France.
Okay, maybe that's who I should have been thinking about. Thank you. Albigensians, yes. Very good. All right, any other comments on the possible interpretation of three distinct groups, three parts. Brother Mark Campbell.
Well, apparently this is a warning by Paul that stayed with him in other letters too. In Galatians, the first chapter, and verse 8, he mentions, but though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. So the whole idea that, people could have either visions or be misled by someone who claims to be an angel and gives an error that he wanted the truth, the actual word of God that they would have access to be the trump card, that this would carry far more weight than anything anybody else would claim to say. And I was thinking of if Satan could appear as an angel, as an angel of light, if you can imagine the sway that would be upon brethren to have an angel appear in a bright shining robes and white and make a statement, this would be pretty hard to say to ignore that. But he's saying that you should listen to the words that they're saying and compare with what we know to be the truth. And carrying that even to our day, where people are looking forward to a return of Christ, that if the Lord allowed angels to reappear and make claims of being the returned Christ and make statements, this would be a real challenge to refute. But we do see that the apostle knew that this would be a rough area for brethren to deal with. So he goes back down to holding on to the word that they have, and not to even an angel of light that would appear unto them. Over.
All right. Thank you, Brother Mark. Yes, certainly lessons throughout the entire gospel age are good warnings. Further comments on this fourth trumpet? Ruth, anything more on your question about the three parts?
No, I'm happy. Thank you.
All right. All right. Well, we appreciate all the comments. We and I appreciate being corrected on the various heretics of old, our dear brethren. And we just don't keep things very well in our memory all the time. So let's go to our interregnum verse, one verse again, where we have a delineation between the first four trumpets and the final three trumpets. And Sister Debbie, would you read Revelation 8, verse 13, please?
And I saw and I heard one messenger flying in the mid-heaven, saying with a great voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those dwelling upon the land, from the rest of the voices of the trumpet of the third of the three messengers who are about to sound." Okay. And I did have a question, Brother Rick, on the previous verse. I was, maybe my brain's just not working, but it said, "In the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise." Is he saying the night didn't shine? Or
the third part. Or the night, third part.
Does the night shine?
Yes, the moon and the stars are in the night sky, and they give the light that was darkened.
Okay, I got it now. Sorry. Over. Okay.
All right, good. Thank you. Sister Cheryl, do you have your diaglot handy? You're good with Rotherhands and diaglot. Read that same verse, because, brother, listen for a couple of corrections in the Greek.
Okay, 8:13. Well, I know diaglot and Rotherham says eagle instead of angel. Diaglot 8:13, and I saw and I heard an eagle flying in the mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth from the remaining blast of the trumpet of those three angels who are about to sound."
Okay. So you identified the word angel or messenger is better rendered eagle, but that second, the other voices of the trumpets. It's not
the remaining blasts of the trumpet of those three angels who are about to sound. A blast?
Yeah. What does that seem to imply, just in a sense?
It's a very strong, loud message.
Yeah. Very good. Did you have anything else on this verse while your mic's open?
Well, just concentrating on the three woes from the three last messengers We know it's a period of enlightenment with the truth. We know at this time the scriptures are in German and in French, and we have the harvest message. So it's hard to ignore the truth if you have a listening ear. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Good start. Brother Chris.
Yeah, I was just going to emphasize, and I beheld or I saw as well as heard. So there was a manifestation. There was something the John class could witness. There was activity with these Wycliffe and his adherents, the Lollards, etc., that he could see its effects. I mean, that's probably true with all of them, but he does say, and I saw and I heard. So it kind of shows both aspects. It wasn't just a message that was troubling. There was an activity that could be seen for what it's worth. Over.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Ruth.
Well, it seems like it shows the Old and New Testament pronouncing these woes, like the truth from the scriptures is released, because now Waldo started the translation, and then the next three trumpets are the releasing of more and more truth, and there are going to be woes upon the nominal system. So, but the truths from the scriptures, the eagle flying, the Old and the New Testament, like in Revelation 12.
Okay, very good. So, if the eagle has two related symbols, though. One is that the eagle is God's wisdom as one of the four character attributes. And another, as Ruth is bringing out in Revelation 12, that the woman was supported by the two wings of a great eagle during that long 1260-year period of persecution when she was in the wilderness. And so a flying eagle demonstrates that the eagle is in motion. So you can look at it properly that the Old and New Testament, the two wings, were going to bring forth the truth more clearly. First with Wycliffe, the fifth messenger, with the English translation of the Bible, then the sixth messenger with Martin Luther bringing forth the German translation of the Bible, and then with the seventh, we didn't need a Bible translation per se, because the Bible societies had already put forth many Bibles and new manuscripts were found, so that we actually have had our flood of Bibles by the time of Brother Russell, our seventh messenger. So it was a time to bring forth the harvest message to elucidate the Word of God, like it hadn't been since the first Advent. So on the one hand, as brought out, it's the Old and New Testament actively bringing forth these next five trumpet blasts. And yet it's also God's wisdom in action, because there's a change in the Gospel age, that the fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpets were going to have they're going to have a far more radical effect than the first four trumpet messages, in a sense. And one of those simple ways of understanding that is our first four trumpets are recorded in six verses. First four trumpets are covered in six verses. But the remaining three take several chapters. So it demonstrates that the Lord is recording for us, as it were, that these fifth, sixth, and seventh trumpets were going to have a more far-ranging effect than had the previous four had done, even though they each did their own work. All right, so Sister Debbie and then Brother Chris.
I'm just wondering if there's any special reason why, Rotherhams and Weymouth, they stressed that it was a solitary eagle or a, and in another version, I guess the concordant literal version, it calls it a vulture, but I'm wondering if maybe if there's a reason it stresses solitary. Over.
Well, the two wings, because the eagle's flying, so it has to be using two wings. That would show the Old and New Testament. But also, a flying eagle, singular, would be God's wisdom. And his wisdom is found in his Bible, of course. Either way, I think it comes out harmonious. Brother Chris.
I was just going to connect it with our Ezekiel study early on with the wheels, which would sometimes be elevated, showing that it was really affecting the spiritual. And other times it would be lowered, kind of affecting the earth. And so here, this eagle or message is in an elevated in motion. So just to keep that all consistent with our symbols and our understanding of God's plan. So over.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Brother David Vickery.
Brother Rick, I noticed in the Diaglot also a reference to Revelation 14:6. It sounds like it's talking about the same thing. I wondered if I could read it.
Sure.
Here they use an angel flying. And I saw an angel flying in mid-heaven having Ionian glad tidings to announce to those who dwell on the earth, even to every nation and tribe and language and people. To me, it seems to be saying the same thing because it seems to be acting as if it's a harbinger of the kingdom, which Waldo kind of started, but Wycliffe, Luther, elaborated much further and clarified it, and Brother Russell brought it all to light. Over.
Okay. Thank you. For the comments. So in our Brother Godwin.
Brother Rick, I've got a question. So you were commenting on the translation of the Bible in Germany and English, putting it corresponding to angels, the fifth and sixth. Am I understanding that right? But I was thinking the Bible was first printed in 1400s during John Wycliffe's period in Germany first, and also he translated in English. Sorry, I might have got myself confused there.
So just our fifth trumpeter is John Wycliffe. And in England, he was a theologian and a scholar at Oxford universities, and he translated the Bible into English. And later, our sixth messenger, Brother Martin Luther, when he was kept safely as a prisoner, but he was kept actually safely in the castle under protection of a prince, he translated the Bible into German. So if the printing press came in 1400s, like you mentioned, for mass print work, but the two different translations of English earlier with Wycliffe, German later with Luther, that's independent of just the printing press. Just on that. Okay. I hope that. So on our verse 13, what we're seeing is a transition in God's plan in the midst of this gospel age. We're seeing that there are the last three trumpet blasts are going to be extreme woes or problems or troubles or worrisome for those who inhabit the earth. and those who inhabit the earth represent the nominal Christians, those Christians who are under religious restraint, but it's the restraint of the nominal churches. First papal and then later Protestant as well. So that the three woes are, in a sense, God's counterattack against the false doctrines and the systems that support false doctrines after he had allowed the false doctrines and these false systems to gain the ascendancy. You'll remember that in the seals, the change came in the fifth seal. You'll recall that in Revelation 6, the first seal opened, there was the white horse, but there was one that was riding upon it going forth to conquer. That was the errors. The second horse was the red, showing the degradation of doctrine. The third was black, showing the doctrine continued to get worse and the practices accompanied with it as the nominal churches gained in power. The fourth, it was a pale horse, a deathly horse, showing the height of doctrinal error and papal power. But when we got to the fifth seal, verse 9, that's where the souls under the altar cried out to the Lord, as if to say, Lord, are you seeing that your truth and those who are upholding your truth are considered heretics and we're being slain? Don't you care? And the Lord says, oh, I do know. I am watching. And you're going to be rewarded, but you have to wait more fully for the rest of your brethren to also be persecuted. So that turning point was the fifth seal. We had four detrimental horses. The doctrine was degraded, the first four. That's similar to our first four trumpet blasts. But when we get to the fifth trumpet blast, the Lord sends forth his horses. We're going to read about that. And his horses are the true doctrines. And in the sixth trumpet, we have the Lord sending forth more horses, more truth doctrines. And in the seventh trumpet, that's the time where the kingdoms of the world have become the kingdom of our God and of his Christ. We don't read of a horse in that trumpet in those verses, but we do read in Revelation 19 that our Lord Jesus returns on a white horse. And those that are with him are also on white horses. So when our Lord returns, he brings back the purity of the doctrine. And those who are in the truth support the true doctrines. So what we see is God's counterattack, and the fifth trumpeter is known as the morning star of the Reformation. The morning star of the Reformation. Martin Luther was the great reformer and the great Reformation beginning proper. And then by the time we get to the seventh trumpet, we actually have the harvest message going forth. It's no longer reforming the church, the nominal church. Now it's, during the seventh trumpet, it's come out of her, my people. It's a forsaking of the nominal church. So with all of that, bit of a background, we want to ask if there are further comments on this verse 13. Bogus.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to Brother David's bringing out chapter 14, verse 6, that those are contrasting verses. One is bad news for the nominal systems, whereas 14:6 is good tidings to all mankind, because the church is complete, and now the message is for everybody. as opposed to the message doing a destructive work, is now doing a building work. Over.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Other comments on verse 13? Sister Alice.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I just want to mention that part of the influences that this in this phase with this messenger was that the Bible was printed. And it's the first book that of any size that was printed in 1456, which would have affected a lot of the effect. It would have affected the truth message going out from the trumpeter to have a Bible printed. And the printing, the various editions that came forth, the German was printed in 1466. The Italian, 1471. The Dutch, 1477. The French, 1487. The Bohemian, 1488. So that would have really had an effect all over Europe when the Bible is printed, and it would have spread the truth a lot faster that way. So.
Okay, very good. And how true it is. Thank you. So in our fifth trumpet, let's read this. It's long. Sister Connie, would you read in Revelation 9, verses 1 through 12, please?
And the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven fallen onto the earth, and there was given to him the key of the well shaft of the abyss. And he opened the shaft of the abyss, and there went up a smoke out of the shaft, as the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the shaft. And out of the smoke came forth locusts upon the earth, and authority was given them, as the scorpions of the earth have authority. And it was said unto them that they should not hurt the grass of the earth, neither any green thing, neither any tree, but only such men as have not the seal of God on their foreheads. And it was given them that they should not kill them, but that they should be tried 5 months. And their trial is as the trial of a scorpion when it striketh a man. And in those days men shall seek death, and shall in no wise find it, and they shall desire to die, and death fleeth from them. And the likenesses of the locusts were like unto horses prepared for war, and upon their heads as it were crowns like unto gold, and their faces were as men's faces. And they had hair as the hair of women, and their teeth were as the teeth of lions. And they had breastplates as it were breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was as the sound of chariots of many horses running to war.
Right through 12.
Oh, sorry. And they have tails like unto scorpions and stings, and in their tails is their power to hurt men 5 months. And they have over them a king, the angel of the abyss. His name is, in Hebrew, is Abaddon, and in the Greek tongue he hath the name Apollyon. The first woe is past. Behold, there come yet two woes hereafter.
All right, very good. Opening comments, Sister Connie, on who this trumpeter might be?
The fifth angel, is that Wycliffe? Is Wycliffe?
Yep. Okay, very good. Appreciate that. And did you have any more you wanted to offer on these opening comments, Sister Connie?
No.
Okay. Well, the mic's open. Brother Dan, did you have any opening comments you'd like to make here?
Oh, I wish I had a lot to say, Brother Rick. But, this is the fifth trumpet, Wycliffe, and we can certainly see the transition as already brought out that God now will begin to put down the error and with the truth, with these with these horses, the proper doctrine will begin to be seen, and it's the truth that strikes down the error. So we see the beginning of the demise of papacy of Babylon here with this first woe, and as brought out in the closing verse, the next two will have this tremendous detrimental effect until Babylon is destroyed. Over.
All right, thank you. Very good. Ruth.
It uses similar language to when Jesus says he beheld Satan fall from heaven, because Wycliffe was considered like a turncoat, like Satan, because he had been a mighty teacher in the church. He was a priest, or was he? I can't remember the exact title, but he was a
theologian.
Theologian, yeah. And so he had quite the influence. His ministry had quite the influence because he had so much influence with the and he knew the languages so well, the Hebrew and the Greek. Over.
All right, very good. So yes, we see a similar action here in this phrase that the fifth angel trumpeted, and I saw a star fall from heaven unto the earth. That reminds us of our third messenger or trumpeter, who was Arius. And in the 8th chapter, verse 10, that third angel messenger trumpeted, and there fell a great star from heaven. And so in both cases, they were both related to being religious men in service, Arius a presbyter, and Wycliffe, a theologian at Oxford, a scholar. And so they were considered, when they preached the truth or presented the truth, they fell from favor in the nominal church heavens. But we just note that our fourth angel that we just discussed, Peter Waldo, he was not mentioned as a star falling from heaven, because he was not considered to be among the religious orders, the way Arius and Wycliffe were. He, as brought out, he was a wealthy merchant. So it's just an interesting little assistance in our interpretations here. Okay, Sister Alice.
Sorry, I was muted. I just wanted to mention that Wycliffe was educated at Oxford, and he got his degree as Doctor of Theology, and then he went on to other colleges, and he was made chaplain to the king, and he was commissioned to the Netherlands to discuss differences with the papal nuncios of Pope Gregory the 11th. When he returned, Wycliffe spoke openly of the papacy being Antichrist, and he warned against her errors and abominations, and against indulgences, crusades, transubstantiation, pilgrimages, and relics. He also denied priestly power of absolution, and he began to issue popular tracts. So he was very, very witness-oriented and against the Catholic doctrine's errors. He also attacked the clergy for their wealth and self-seeking. And then he organized the Lollards. But what's interesting, and I think is the best thing that I remember, is John Huss was one of his students, and it went back to, where was John Huss?
Is that Czechoslovakia?
Yeah, Czechoslovakia. And he brought all of this information with him, and that's where Luther got it. So there was like a link between Wycliffe and Luther. John Huss was the one that linked with the, all this information in the different colleges. And then, of course, Hess was burned at the stake. But that's a little bit of background.
I appreciate that. Very good. Thank you. J&M.
Yes, thank you, Brother Rex, Brother James. My comment was going to be on the phrase, that the star that had fallen, just to elaborate a little more on that. Especially in, you know, we don't use it now, but most of the history of humanity has used stars to navigate. So thinking of a star falling in the papist mind, that would mean like this man Wycliffe is no longer good to use as a navigation or as a guiding a force for either his followers or the priests that he would be teaching eventually, you know, the wannabe priests that he would be teaching. So they would view him as somebody that wouldn't be a trustworthy source to follow. Over.
All right. That's very good. We appreciate that. They would use the sextant on the open waters as a means of guiding them from point to point, the sailors and merchants. And it is marvelous that they had that kind of science, and that's true. If a star is not in its proper course, it can't be relied upon. And if it's fallen from the skies, the heavens, it's absolutely cannot be used in that way. So we appreciate that. The nominal church felt that Wycliffe was no longer a proper teacher because he was renouncing the papal errors. One of the things of interest during this time period of 1367 till 1517, the time of Martin Luther, that's our 150-year period, are 5 months that are mentioned twice in this fifth trumpet. 5 times 30 equals 150, a day for a year, 150 years from the start to the finish. And we've covered that at length in the past. I'm just saying that to the lead in to say that there were two popes at this time period, or during this time period. And then, in fact, later, as a means of trying to respond to the charges of corruption in the papacy by its critics, one prominent critic was John Wycliffe, is brought out. They even instituted a third pope to try to replace the previous two, who were supposedly popes at the same time. So that it helped set the stage for John Wycliffe's partial message, showing the corruption of the papacy at the highest levels. And he also spoke out against the mendicant friars, which they're known as the begging friars, that were begging money from the poorer people in order to use the money to fund lavish lifestyles among the papal clergy. And this, too, was pointed out as part of the clerical abuse of the papacy and corruption. So that John Wycliffe was able to attack both. The doctrinal errors is brought out. In fact, Fox's Books of Martyrs suggests that John Wycliffe was the first to refer to the Pope as Antichrist. And so he could attack, he attacked them along false doctrines, and he attacked them along the line of clergy corruption. So it's no wonder that in our first verse, to him, to this fallen star, was given the key of a bottomless pit, or the abyss, as Sister Connie's translation read. And a key denotes authority. So he seems to have authority in order, or the power, to open this bottomless pit, this abyss. And all these terrible things come out of this abyss. So we don't have time, or just about out, but let's just leave off with what would be these terrible things that might come out of this abyss, or what was in, what is the abyss? Or what does an abyss represent in the revelation? Maybe that's a better way of putting it. Brother Chris, and then Ruth, and we'll have to wind down.
Well, an abyss is like a bottomless pit. It's darkness. The depth of it is kind of unknown. Typically, that's the picture that comes to mind when we think of an abyss, a very deep trough, and you never quite know what's going to come out of it because it's not revealed until it is revealed. But I was thinking part of what formed this abyss was, it's a repeat comment from earlier, but 1367 is only 20 years after the Black Plague, and all the good, those that were good-hearted and genuine, well-meaning priests that were part of the nominal systems were killed off because they were the ones out helping people, actually trying to do good. Well, they would get the plague and they'd be dead. And so all that was left were like the most wretched. They would desperately bring in people without training, without any real knowledge of the word, and just make them priests so that they could go out there. And so this formed really an abyss of the most dismal kind of spiritual leaders. And it makes you think of when Assyria came in and took out Samaria. They came in and they replaced all the priests with the most basest of spiritual leaders. So we kind of have a type there, and that would be the Edda type. And so Wycliffe, the Lord couldn't raise anybody up from the spiritual system like he did Luther. By that time, things had gotten a little bit better to select somebody of good heart from the nominal systems. So he turned to the academic community, which is where Wycliffe, he was somewhat protected by his stature and notability. So for whatever that's worth, over.
All right. Thank you. Ruth.
I was thinking of continuing this, the picture of Satan falling from heaven, and that's where in Revelation 20, Satan is considered as being bound, that Wycliffe was considered like Satan from the standpoint of the nominal churches, and he would not only be in the bottomless pit, but he had the key of it, so that he was like the chief one, and that's how he was considered. Over.
All right, very good. So our Revelation 20, verse 3, has an abyss, and that usually shows restraint, something under restraint. In Revelation 20, it's Satan and his influence is being restrained. That's good. Here, from the nominal church point of view, Wycliffe was bringing out truth from the Bible, the Bible that the papists had kept in an abyss under restraint in the Latin language. So they kept the people in the dark. And that was the restraint of the Bible. The Bible was restrained in an abyss. But Wycliffe is now able to open this abyss, and out of the Bible that had been under papal restraint in dead language of Latin, now putting it in English, all these terrible things seem to come out from the papal point of view, which we'll have to get into next week. So, brethren, we'll have to close here.